Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. That's me.
And unfortunately, Brian Brushwood could not make it this week.
That's right,
man. Brian is here.
Old Brian Brushwood is dead and gone. I've been reborn. I'm now a symbiote with the COVID. We are one. We got the president.
Now we're going
to take over the world.
I know you've had to talk about this to death, but for our Weird Things listeners, all they heard was, Brian got sick.
Yeah, man, we didn't know. We had no idea how long it was going to last. And it's really interesting. We were pretty early on the COVID story because we were talking about it when it was just in China. And we followed it the entire time. We do daily programs where all we do is talk about COVID. Having said that, I thought I was fairly well educated about the disease. And then I caught it. And then you realize how little you know and how little you understand about the mortality rates and about comorbid conditions and about what to expect and how long. And the only talk on the street I'd heard is if you get it, expect 2 to 3 weeks of until you could possibly do anything. And luckily, I had a mild case. It was intense, but it was short. I think the hard part was about 72 hours long, including vomiting, diarrhea, fever, and the most severe chills I've ever had, like to the point where my whole body was like a lower body catalepsy. My legs were kicking nonstop. And I went 30 hours without sleep that first bout and started to hallucinate at one point. But then fever broke within right around the 72-hour mark. And then since then, it's been kind of a long, steady march of waves of fatigue and a little bit of fog and a little bit of kind of achiness. But as of today, just under 2 weeks since the event? Is that? No, we're almost 2 weeks. No, two weeks, almost to the day.
Wednesday
was
when
I was
vomiting.
Would be
2 weeks from your positive test.
Yes.
Yeah.
And symptoms started before that. So I'm just about 2 weeks out. As of this morning, if I'm not 100%, I'm close enough to it that I can't tell the difference.
And you're even out there like exercising and stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Like my dad got it. And he also had very mild symptoms. This was months ago. And I think he would go out and run and jog and stuff, but he could tell that kind of, his lung capacity was a little diminished, but otherwise he made it through okay.
Yeah, I've been messing around with the pulse oximeter. I actually bought it. Part of the reason I bought this new watch is because it has a pulse, you know, oxygen measurer to see how good your lungs are working. And that's also part of why I've been doing these walk jogs and stuff, is to kind of just sort of prod at like, okay, do I have any kind of lasting things? And like I said, man, 8 miles is a lot for me. And granted, half of it was walking, but it felt pretty good. Bonnie had milder symptoms, but they lasted much longer. It lasted about twice as long, and then but she was better by the 10-day mark since the first symptoms came. But I don't know what it is, but as I told Justin on Friday, every time I recover from COVID, the president gets it, and that's 100% correlation. I don't get it.
Yeah, there we go.
Well, that's the, you know, it's kind of, you know, you're at that point where the people I know who've been getting it are people who have to kind of like do real work and interact with people, you know, and that is the, you know, that we're a long way past the 15 days to stop, you know,
the spread,
the curve.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, oh yeah, 15 days, we can do that. And then it's like, yeah, at the point, like, yeah, no, people are going to, you know, again, got to be safe. And I'm not saying anything about like trying to diminish anything, but it is like for many people, have to take greater risks than I do sitting at home with my spaceship models.
Yeah. Somebody in the chat asked if I gained weight. No, as a matter of fact, in that first 48 hours, the nausea was so profound that, between the vomiting, diarrhea, and nausea, I couldn't barely choke down half a piece of toast. I lost 6 pounds in the first 48 hours. Down to the lowest weight I've seen in the last, maybe 5 years. And
so was a net positive.
What's well, I mean, obviously all of that is water weight, and once my nausea went away, man, I couldn't stop eating. I, in about 36 hours, ate, I kid you not, a gallon of homemade chicken soup from my mom. And on top of that, you know, the crackers and all the Gatorades and all that stuff. So I put on like 8 pounds in the following 36 hours. It was a real ride. And even now I'm still down 2 pounds from where I was before the disease. It was a crazy trip. And as I mentioned, and it's hard to say this, please don't think that this is me diminishing the importance of the disease, but I could say without hesitation that the fear and anxiety of not clearly understanding what the path was in front of me was worse than the disease itself. I think because what I've since learned is there's the vaccine that they're working on. There's two phases. The first one, you get mild symptoms. And then the second one, the booster, is when you pretty much have 24 hours of full blown COVID symptoms. And the FDA, the quote they had is, while they are unpleasant, they are not dangerous. And I think if the context had changed, if it was just as awful an experience, but it was after taking a vaccine and I could hold on to that idea of the FDA saying it's unpleasant, but not dangerous, I think I would have just, you know, taken some NyQuil and slept through the night. But instead, I mean, that being up for 30 hours was a real terror fest. It was awful. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy.
Well, I appreciate that, Brian. Thank you. very glad to see you through this the other side. I've had, you know, some friends that had pretty severe cases, that a lot of lingering stuff, and it's like that dice. It's like that roulette of, like, you know, how does it hit? You know, which I guess is kind of the scary part.
I was surprised. A few of the things that surprised me, I did not know that the number was this high. 40% of all cases totally asymptomatic, which is much higher than I had thought.
I got a worksheet after I got a rapid test that was like, here are all the I got a negative test, but it was like 5 to 60% of people are asymptomatic, which is kind of a large
range. Oh my
God,
that's a 60?
Maybe they meant 50 to 60, but this was like, they pulled out all the stops to print me a piece of paper. I would assume that was correct.
That's funny. And I guess
how scary is it if that's 60? How scary is that if that's a typo?
You do a lot of digging around on the CDC site when you've got the disease, and you eventually, like I eventually stumbled across, like the total morbidity rate is 0.00003, which I believe is 0.003%. Maybe I hope I'm not putting an extra zero in there. But anyway, it's much lower than I had in my head. And of course, when you're in the middle of an anxiety event, logic doesn't have a really good foothold in your brain.
No. All you're kind of looking at are these like top line numbers and anecdotal stories of people that are around your, you know, age or whatever, and then extrapolating the worst case scenario from there. But I think that we don't know what's going on with this disease still. I mean, like, this is very young for us to even have the kind of handle that we do have on it. So it's not like we're doing a bad job. We're in fact probably doing the best job anybody in modern history has ever done with a virus this bad. The only thing is that's not exactly up to snuff with a world that has on-demand knowledge for so much, right? Like, this is just... This is only going to move as fast as it can. And despite the fact that we have developed vaccines at this kind of record pace, we do have the information and we are tracking the various different strains of it. The only thing that we can do is just continue to share our experiences and try to be knowledgeable about it.
So, Brian, question, anything with the loss of smell?
No, but that was something I was really dialed in on was every time I washed my hands, you know, periodically, like once a day, I would make a loose fist and sniff my hand and make sure I could smell the soap on there. Apparently that is very, very tightly correlated. Like if you have loss of sense of smell or taste, that's apparently not too many ways to get there outside of COVID right now.
How about COVID toes? Any COVID toes?
No, I checked for that as well. I really
COVID toes?
Oh yeah, are you not familiar with
I don't know about that symptom.
Your toes turn purple.
No.
Yeah. What? Google that.
If I Google COVID toes and I get a bunch of OnlyFans, I'm going to be really Wow. No,
does
I guess
to you a lot, Bryce.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Hey, Bryce, look. Do you like the lights being on in HQ? Because Brian's got to keep this money coming in one way or another.
Wow. Okay. So that's a thing. COVID. Yeah. So you didn't get any?
No. As a matter of fact, I actually early on, day one, what I found is diarrhea and vomiting tend to be more associated with milder cases. And so that was sort of an early, like 1/3 of mild cases have diarrhea. So weirdly, having the poops was like, okay, that's probably a good sign because I'm not having any trouble breathing. I did develop a very light cough, like once every 15 minutes, I would just do not a deep racking cough, just almost like a throat clearing kind of like that kind of thing. And maybe 4 times an hour, I would cough like that.
Cool. Well, Brian, we're glad you're well. As smoothly as the show functioned without you, I mean, like super smoothly, like amazing how well it went. We're glad you're here.
Okay. Also, Bryce, can I talk to you after the show about Operation Fly Free?
You know, if you want to support more experiments like this, this was actually planned. We didn't tell you that. Yes, it was Brian won a bet, which is the really weird thing about how things go here. And help support us.
We should point out that the last phone call I had, I don't know if I told you this, Andrew, I felt fine after I got my positive diagnosis and I went to bed early at 9 o'clock and then the phone rings and it's Andrew Main. I pick up the phone in bed and I say hello. And then the first words out of Andrew's mouth are, so you get to be first to test drive this, huh? like with a hint of jealousy. And I was like, we talked for like 20 minutes and then I hung up. I was like, now to go to bed early. 10 minutes later, the fever and chills just hit, just like a switch turned on. And then I was like, oh, crap. Buckle in. Here we go.
Well, I mean, I'm going to be honest, like, I hope I don't get it. I hope I get vaccinated with this. The thing that worries me the most is like, hey guys, I got COVID too. Yeah, no, Andrew, we've already done the story. We already know everything about it.
Oh,
let me tell you about my, no, this is old news, Andrew.
Yeah.
Like me talking about The Wire.
It's going to be crazy because obviously there's been X amount of Americans that have already had it. It seems as if we are in another kind of like spreading moment. You know, whenever people that you've heard of get it, it means a lot of people that you haven't heard of have probably gotten it. Now, the question that then kind of becomes of it is like, all right, so let's say that Brian and his wife had that illness, right, but didn't have the wherewithal or the compunction to go get a test, right, and instead just kind of live their lives. Like, would they even know it as COVID, right? Like if you were to remove it from that. So it's like, maybe it's everywhere right now. Maybe a lot of people have it, but because it has such a high asymptomatic rate, because like the strain that at least you got is something that was milder, let's cross our fingers with some of the public officials that have gotten it, that this is something that is lighter than some of the strains that have been going around earlier or even during the summer. Like, we don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see.
In our case, Bonnie and I got it, picking up the puppy, listen to Night Attack. We've talked about it a few times as to how we got it, stepping outside of our bubble. And it looks like I infected one of our team members who appears to be, I believe today or tomorrow is day 14 since exposure. No, today is 14 days since exposure. And he, while testing positive, has been totally asymptomatic. So that's one who, if we did not know to get everyone tested, could have been a super spreader. But I mean, he stays in his bubble anyway. My wife, her symptoms were mild enough that she never would have thought outside of, she got a little bit of a version of the leg tremor thing that I talked about. And that would have kind of weirded her out. But outside of that, all of her symptoms, she just thought was part of, you know, having her monthly. And she never would have attributed it to COVID if she hadn't gotten tested. So 2 out of 3 people in just our experience never would have known.
And to our audience, we're not trying to underscore how dangerous or deadly it can be to certain people in certain cases. And we you know, results may vary. So,
yeah, my point is to the infectiousness of it and how easy it is to not realize that people are spreading it around.
Oh, no, for sure. And I know you as somebody who's experienced it firsthand, and, you know, it's very real for you. And I just want to, for our people out there who might be like, oh, yeah, you know, Brian beat COVID. Yeah. Why can't you? Like, well, like, it's more complicated. We take this thing very, very seriously. Like, and to your, again, to your point, like, yeah, how easily this thing can spread. You know, we, like I said, we were banging that drum early on.
Yeah.
And that was a tweet that I got criticized for. I'm like, hey, listen, the thing about this is when you're looking at infection rates, that told you what happened a week or 2 weeks ago. It's far ahead of where it is. I'm like, oh, you're scaremongering or whatever. It was like back in February. And I'm like, am I?
Well, I'll tell you what. Here's where you can be in the sweet life of a Patreon supporter. Patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can go to keep this ramshackle show on the road. You can get your custom RSS feed, get the After Things podcast. Everything you need is right there. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
Gentlemen, good news. Something that finally, some good news for 2020, unequivocal, nothing could go wrong.
Okay.
Scientists.
I believe you 100%.
Yeah. Scientists have successfully extracted DNA from insects trapped inside of tree resin, inside of
amber. No, we're one step closer. Hold on to your butts.
Wait, one step closer to understanding DNA that's trapped in resin, Brian. Yes, that is exciting. I don't know why you're that excited.
Excuse me, I'm going to be buying futures in Chilean sea bass.
That's amazing. Do you think, Michael Crichton spoke about how he couldn't believe that Scientific American was running serious articles about his crazy science fiction thing. Like, man, I just took some crazy ideas I had and you all are treating it like for reals. What's going on here? And now here we are 30 years later with them continuing to treat it for reals.
They have to say, however, we have no intention of raising dinosaurs.
You have to have the dinosaur disclaimer. And I want to know why the hell not.
Yeah, right? Like, whoa, let's not start closing any doors here.
I mean, yeah, who likes funding? I'm
supposed to think you're the cool guys?
Yeah, man. So what are the details on it? Does it look just like in the movie? They drill a hole and take a syringe and you
well,
got dinosaurs.
Actually, what they have the trick is trying to figure out the right way to separate the resin from the organism to get to the DNA and trying to figure out basically how do you do that? Like, how do you dissolve the resin without destroying the DNA? And that is a tricky thing. And this is... I get on this rant a bit because one of the things I think is that there are things that are kind of like physically impossible. Like we don't know a way around it, like time travel and warp drives. They're neat ideas, but we have to invent things that aren't part of physics to do that. Beyond that, when somebody goes, no, that's impossible. You can't do it. It's like, it may not be an area anybody really tried. You know, it may not be an area. There's a lot of research, you know, that was. When Crichton wrote Jurassic Park, people said, oh, the idea of getting DNA that's millions of years old, that's ridiculous. Like you point out, like Scientific American had these articles like, oh, that's silly. And it's like, well, yeah, at that point, we didn't know. Another thing, nobody is ever trying to do it. And, you know, we found, you know, later on that like, oh, well, there's, you know, DNA kind of has a half-life. Well, in certain conditions, it will break down. But we're now finding that in certain conditions, DNA lasts much longer. There's situations where DNA will bind with iron molecules and form these little balls. And people are like, well, yeah, but you to try to take them apart, you'll break them. I'm like, wait, we just went from being there was no DNA to now there is DNA that could be millions of years old. And that's another problem we got to solve, but that just changed things.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's kind of two different types of problems. There's fundamental scientific problems. And then there's engineering problems. So something like time travel breaks causality, right? Or, unless we discover something new about many worlds or figure out a way to verify them by, you know, gravimetric pulses or whatever, you know, whatever. So those are unlikely to have anything happen anytime soon. Having a first stage of a rocket land vertically is an engineering problem. Yes, it's very, very hard, but it's not impossible. Going to the moon was an engineering problem. Extracting DNA from millions of years ago appears to me to be an engineering problem, which means like there's no fundamental scientific reason that we can't get all that. And even like freezing heads and then reanimating them in the future. Right now, yeah, if you do that, you're going to get crystals that slice apart your brain. You're going to get freeze-dried mush 1,000 years from now. But that's an engineering problem. There's no fundamental reason that we can't chop off a head and freeze it and put it in a robot body 1,000 years from now.
I mean, we might have an information problem that like once something's dead, the neurons don't sort of save their state. You know, there could be things like that, like it's, you know, kind of like wiping, you know, you could revive a brain, but be like a brain dead person because all the memories could go on. But yeah, there might be. But yeah, and to your point, like, yeah, there's a lot of stuff where we just go, it's like, no, like maybe we don't know, but there's this thing called science that changes what we know every year and keeps moving forward. And, you know, the dinosaur stuff too, is that look at the advancement of artificial intelligence and looking at genetic sequences. And Crichton made kind of like one mistake that was apparent at the time in Jurassic Park, which was when he talked about gaps in DNA and having to plug in like, you know, tree frog DNA, yeah. It was like, no, because like if you have 1,000 broken strands, like 1,000 separate strands of let's say Triceratops DNA, they're all going to be broken at different points. So a computer could go back and figure out what a whole sequence should look like. Right. But it was fine. For when he went, he is so right on everything else, was so brilliant, didn't matter. But now, you know, you could get to the point where you could have an AI and say, how would I build, you know, what do I need to do? Let's take some bird DNA, you know, in a theropod and say, what do I need to make a T-Rex? What would you do? How big would the skull need to be? What could you do? And you could reverse engineer a T-Rex. And if you had access to DNA, you could say, oh yeah, we got pretty close to the sequence here. This seems like a match here. And that's one of the things we find out is that, you know, we share like 99% of our DNA with a chimpanzee. You know, a T-Rex is going to probably share, you know, 95% of it with a, you know, with a vulture or something. And it might not be hard to sort of find a way to do it.
Well, and it's interesting. The idea of a computer simulation is interesting because presumably if before we physically manipulate any DNA to create an actual dinosaur, if we understand enough to physically do it, it seems like we would understand enough to model it in a computer simulation. So we could have a virtual actual Jurassic Park based on the actual data that we have and plug in models of real world stuff to see kind of how it would turn out. That'd be fun.
Oh, yeah. I we talked about this before in another episode. When I wanted to do my shark experiment and work, you know, to do the thing with the great white sharks, I was told how great white sharks behave. I was told that they're ambush predators. And so when you're not looking at them, they will sneak up on you, right? So they tell you're not looking. So I went into VR and I built a very simple AI for a great white, which was not even really an AI, just a very simple systems level thing where it was when the target is, when it's not facing you, that's when your likelihood of you trying to go attack would be. When I went to go test this thing in VR, it was just like when I did it for real, like how when my attention was over here, and that showed me like, man, you can do some very simple things to model the behavior of organisms that can, you know, be. And that's what a lot of like AI and a lot of stuff like Game of Life and stuff sort of based on. A few simple rules have really complex outcomes and can be very convincing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm afraid to go. I'm afraid to step any farther because we're at the edge of my understanding of things.
Well, I think the idea though, that you're saying though, like doing virtually creating dinosaurs, things like this and building ecosystems, that will be the way to think, I think, do it is to build really sophisticated ones inside of Unity and stuff and go there and try it and bigger systems. And we could learn a lot because once you start building these complex ecosystems, we could actually learn more about what life was like for them than we could if we actually built a Jurassic Park. Because our oxygen content in our atmosphere today, a lot of these other things are very different than it was 65 million years ago. And we would be interested to do that, but a model would give us even more.
Yeah, that's one of those things.
But I still want dinosaurs.
That they never explained in school. And it wasn't until I was in my late 30s that I found out. Like, you know, when you're in school, you find out about like 3-foot-long cockroaches and gigantic dragonflies and insects that are so huge. And you're like, well, why don't we have those now? And, you know, you see in the movies sometimes they'll have them appear. But it wasn't until my late 30s that I found out that the only reason they were that big is because there was so much more oxygen in the air at that time than there is nowadays.
Yeah. Tally Zarel says, not even a simulation. We could probably have the data we have right now and use an Excel format and make predictions based on that. Yeah, but boring. but no, absolutely 100% right. And that is a thing that's done in like a lot of population statistics, things like this. That's like my character Theo Cray does when he's studying like, you know, different biomes and stuff, and think is that he, you know, builds his mathematical models to study it. And, you know, he looks at a spreadsheet and gets excited because, oh, look at this. And other people are like, I don't know. But yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you could do that. But on the exciting part, though, is, you know, building an ecosystem that's for real.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
And we talked about, I don't know if there's been an update, but remember Jack Horner, the paleontologist, he had a project where what they wanted to do was take a bird DNA, because birds go through stages in their embryonic development where there's a point at which like they have like fingers that fuse. They have like they have teeth that sort of get absorbed back in and sort of stop some of these functions, not add any DNA, but actually revert back to sort of the primal sort of bird aspects of that.
Wild.
And just try to. Yeah, you wanted to create a dinosaur just out of the DNA that's already in a present day bird.
Man,
let me see if there's an update on that.
So question, I guess you start with the tree resin bugs and you play around and you see if you could get a full sequence from bugs and compare them to known bugs like in recent times. And I guess you start playing, going farther and back and back and back. And right now we're in the information gathering. Like, let's say they crack this. I suppose for decades, all we do is one at a time, try to get full sequences of every type of bug we can. And then phase one is collect genetics. Phase three, profit, right?
How did I not know this? Hold on. Jack has a GoFundMe for making a live dinosaur.
No way.
Oh, what?
Oh, my God. I got it. Because this was the plan, was to do just take existing, like just stop, use the existing DNA in the chicken. GoFundMe/making a live dinosaur.
300K, that's not much.
Hold on.
Man, like, he should have reached out to Justin for advice on crowdfunding. He could have helped out a lot. I know, right?
Well, it's still going on. I got to email Jack and ask him, is this a thing? Because, like, I think if there's anything we need to lend our support to.
Oh, my God, yeah. Dino chicken. A living, breathing animal that would fit right in among its ancestors 70 million years ago. Due to recent advances, my dream to re-engineer a dinosaur traits in birds is becoming reality. Holy cow. I mean, I guess, you know what? What's funny is... kind of like, and this is kind of a nasty thought, but no more nastier than industrial meats. Like in a world where bonsai trees are curated to look like tiny big trees, why not do a bonsai on a chicken? And no, it genetically will bear no resemblance to a T-Rex, but my guess is you could put some sculpting things to shape a head, like you could put braces on a baby.
All right. We gotta get in touch with Jack, because like this definitely, if this is for real, we gotta put some weight into it. And if it's not, we need to put the lie to it.
Tally Zarel is 100% right. Didn't we do that with dogs? Yeah. I mean, if we did it with dogs, let's do it with chickens, make little T-Rexes.
What Jack was doing is that, like, because if you look at the embryonic development of a chicken, it goes, there's a point where it has teeth, and then there's genes switch up that off, is to get rid of the gene that says stop this. It's basically just use the start and stop sequences to let it follow the course to be in a dinosaur.
Whoa.
So I know Jack, and I gotta ask Jack about this.
No, you gotta reach out, because this apparently was launched on April 2nd, which I guess now we now know historically not the best time to be asking people for money on April 2nd
last year.
Yeah. So okay, yeah. So it's well over a year old then. And even the top donations are not what I would expect top donations to be when Jack Horner wants to make a real live dinosaur, because I would expect he's probably got a group chat that can shake loose 10x what is in that top donors thing within 5 seconds.
Yeah, I'm actually emailing right now.
Okay.
All right. All right. Well, while we wait for that, let's look to the future, right, Brian? What's your favorite part about the future?
Oh man, I love the fact that it hasn't happened yet. We don't know exactly how it's going to go. For example, remember a year ago when everyone was saying, "Boo, 2019. Let's put this terrible year behind us. Let's look forward to 2020."
Can we stop angering years? I feel like let's stop picking fights with years and putting years down.
I mean, I think we saw what happened when because it was certainly the loudest that I'd heard it in 2019. I think it became a bit of a fad for everyone to hate on a particular year, the previous year. But now we've seen the fruits of what that bears out. So
exactly. Let's
not I don't want to be the negative dude, the doomsayer, because I'm overly optimist, but I'm like, just an idea like, oh, 2020 is the worst. Like people were like in like 1939. Oh man, this year sucks.
Oh, no, 1940. I'm not going to say it's the worst. I'm just, my adjective of choice is bonkers. There's no doubt that this is a bonkers year relative to most of the years I've lived in my life.
I'm just saying, how do we know it ain't going to be the decade? I'm just saying like, oh, this year, just this year. Only it'll be this year, because, you know, we all know on January 1st, 2021, it's going to be all sunshine and rainbows, and we're all going to be singing together. Like, Robert Heinlein talked about the crazy years. That was his thing in his books, was like the period at which things got really, really crazy. And so I hope. I sent Bryce a link. This was a really cool, very super, super nerdy thing, but the CGI company went and created a visualization, Metal Ball Studios, of all of different, like, fictional starships showing their relative sizes.
Oh, wow.
And so, it starts zooming. Like, we start with small stuff, like from Men in Black. We get the attack ball from Dragon Ball Z. We get the TARDIS, which is 3 meters tall, and it's moving across. We get the Space Cruiser from Rick and Morty. Next to it, we get a size comparison of how big that is. And let me just say that I never realized how many spaceships there were in, like, fiction video games. Bryce is going to go speed this through because it's pretty damn fast. TIE Fighters, Stargate Puddle Jumpers. And we're going to go all the way up in size to things like Star Destroyers, Halo Rings, etc. as this sort of moves through.
That's awesome. I did see that it just did the Dragon capsule, so you have some real things in there. I'm hoping that the Falcon Heavy shows up at some point. And I assume all of this is from the canonical from Wikipedia or what have you.
Yeah, from what we think it really was supposed to be. Oh, there's a space shuttle, so yeah, there's that. So it's a very cool thing to watch. It sort of moves through because you start recognizing the different spacecraft and things like from the Milano, from Guardians of the Galaxy, and it keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger in size.
There's the ISS.
So I think they've added what looks like Manhattan in the background to kind of give you a sense
of scale.
Like, scale with buildings. Yeah, these are pretty large, about 1.4 kilometers.
Battlestar Galactica looks like it could kick the Enterprise's butt.
Yep. But you know, we're still, you know, start seeing, like, there's a Star Destroyer. So we're seeing the size of that.
Great. Yeah.
Manhattan's a great thing. The Event Horizon ship caught me by surprise. Is that, like,
that's a big one.
Yeah.
It's in the same breath as Titan AE.
Wow, or the mothership from District 9. Oh, that's great. Oh, and they keep on going with the Borg cube.
Oh yeah. It's, let me put it this way. We go way beyond Manhattan scale in these models.
Here, I'll skip ahead a little bit.
Yeah, can we? Yeah, let's skip to the end here.
Oh my gosh, we haven't even gotten. Oh my god, we have so much longer to go.
So these ones now, they're showing you can visibly see the curvature of the Earth. They are so large. So the Sol.
Well, I guess I assume we're going to see a Death Star here any second.
There was the background. We actually had the tiny ones, okay. The 1 and 2. Yeah,
and then bigger than the sun.
What is the sun is so tiny? What is this?
Dun, dun, Ring dun. World, a Dyson sphere. Oh, that's great. Oh, that's fun.
That's awesome. That's Metal Ball Studios. Shout out to them. That is awesome.
We'll have the link in the show notes.
Yeah. No, V'ger's in there, by the way. People should point out V'ger, not including the cloud, is in there from Star Trek, the motionless picture.
There was a lot of standing.
I can't believe I said that out loud. I don't. Things that are cool, but maybe, I don't know. There is a, we've seen different versions of using turbines and jets to propel people. One of the things we've seen is the kind of the Iron Man thing with the jets mounted around the arms. And so there is a headline, jet suit paramedic tested in the Lake District could save lives.
Oh, wow.
Basically, it's the idea of having a paramedic like fly in using this jet suit, which I think sounds really cool. I just don't know that.
Well,
that's
if you think about it, I mean, I assume there's no human piloting in this, or maybe there is, but then that's less cool. I think, like, in terms of, like, just strap on, if what you need is a paramedic, like, just strap this on and the computer takes you the shortest route and then just drops you off. That seems like that would be useful, but like having a cool jet ski in the sky for a paramedic.
Yeah, no,
seems...
what you describe is cool, but we're watching a guy suit up, get into this thing, put this stuff on, operate the turbines, and so it looks amazing.
Are they his hands? Is that where the turbines are? On his hands as little gloves?
Yeah.
90 seconds to fly over what would be a 25-minute walk. I mean, it's straight up, it does. It looks exactly like Iron Man hovering in place.
And this is on a hill where it would be tough to hike or trek up somewhere by foot for sure.
It's just I'd be more excited, like what Brian talked about, the idea of, you know, a vehicle that you hop onto, because here we're watching a guy who is trained to fly in this thing, and it's amazing to watch this guy fly around in this thing is absolutely crazy cool. But it looks like it can fly for 5 to 10 minutes, you know, 85 miles per hour.
That's to me where the rubber meets the road, is like where that would be most effective are either in, you know, a ocean or rocky or mountainous terrain that is hard to move around, either by walking, or very long to walk, or impossible to take a vehicle, that you would have something that you could search for somebody or people could, you know, see you. And it's like, if you're only out there for 5 to 10 minutes, then that's not exactly the...
That's the other thing. It's like, imagine you're at a ranger station out in, you know, remote New Zealand or whatever, and you get on the radio, "Help, I've fallen and I've broken my arm. Where are you? I'm by a mountain, like in between two big jagged cliffs." And then it's like, you're up and around and you're looking like, can you help me? I mean, maybe if they had a signal flare or something, you were able to, you know, just follow the smoke trail or something. But
now, I will say that in a world where we do have... ability to communicate or to have some kind of location data shared easier than we have in the past, maybe it's more feasible to just be like, "Oh, no, this is only for when we know exactly where you are and it would just take longer to get out there." Boy. And this is like immediate first aid that could save your life, depending on what happens in that intervening 30 minutes to an hour. Like, okay, I can see it. It still seems pretty specialized to me, though.
Well, from what we understand about this technology and the other demonstrations we've seen, it's, you got to be specially trained to do it. And versus like Brian's computer-controlled flight vehicle, which I think that's exciting. The idea of hop on this thing, it knows how to fly, it knows how to get you there. So that way our ambulance technicians don't have to be 180-pound, you know, super athletes trained in, you know, flight suit operation.
Yeah.
Willing to be proven wrong. Very, very willing to be proven wrong. And I do think those turbines are very cool. And we've seen like the motorbikes, like the hover bikes, examples of those, which are cool, you know, so, you know, we'll get there. Do you guys want to do some picks?
Yeah. Can I give a duopoly of picks? Justin and I talked a little bit about this on Friday. During my convalescence, I watched The Social Dilemma, which made me think of which is an anti pick for me.
Brian, I watched The Social.
Oh, okay, let's talk about it. But what it leads me to is the antithesis of it, which is The Pessimist's Archive, which we've talked about, is utterly fantastic. And in The Social Dilemma, they pick quite possibly the worst metaphor they possibly could. And as the folks over at The Pessimist's Dilemma point out, nobody fact checked this because they allow one of the main characters to say to camera, "When the bicycle came out, nobody freaked out. Nobody said, oh my gosh, this is terrible. It's the end of society." And then on this most recent episode of The Pessimist Dilemma, not only had they done an entire episode about the bicycle hysteria and how people were convinced it was the end of the world, he goes on to just rattle off just like 12 headlines saying riding a bicycle could be fatal. It could be this. It's the end of society. It's terrible for women. It's causing people to divorce. It's all the hysterias. And then if you're familiar with the "this time it's different" argument that you hear again and again and again in The Pessimist Dilemma, as they examine hysterias around novels, operas, elevators, dancing, the waltz, all of these things, then you kind of recognize that The Social Dilemma is a weird movie in that it gets all the details, almost all the details right, and yet comes to the exact wrong conclusion, and also offers weirdly no suggestive solutions to all the problems that they're making up. What did you think, Justin?
Oh, it does. It offers very unworkable and ridiculous solutions because I hated it. I hated it so much that I'm judging friends that recommended it to me. And if you tell me you like it, then I'm going to think less of you. So I thought it was an embarrassment. I thought that the scripted interstitials were reefer madness, laughable. Yes. to the point of a parody that anybody on earth was taking this seriously. I think that it buries even just an elementary understanding of the business model of these businesses under so much hysteria that I think you will actively know this issue less if you watch and believe The Social Dilemma.
I'm so glad that you said reefer madness, because you're so right. This is the reefer madness of social media.
It is. It's like, you know, and I'm not saying that there's not problems. Spoiler alert, the problem's us. It's not the algorithms for which push. Yes, it can amplify the worst elements of us. It also amplifies the best elements of us. And to their credit, they at the very least mentioned that up top of like, oh, we saw that we were doing good. What we didn't realize is we were also doing bad. The one thing that bothers me more than Silicon Valley's self-importance complex that makes every little incremental thing that they do literally bringing fire to the tribe is now the dark side of that, where they have to explain, oh, we also brought society's curse. Why are we so brilliant? And that's effectively what I felt The Social Dilemma was. Combine that with whatever money they got from Netflix.
There is, I have a little bit more of a complicated feeling because the four of us on this podcast are fairly techno-literate, and it's no surprise. All of the facts came as no surprise to us when they say things like we're more polarized than we've never been. We get trapped in our own bubbles and we disagree on basic facts and all that stuff. None of that was news to us. So all we had was the bizarre cartoonish melodrama that they wrapped it around in their cinematics that you're right was laughably reefer madness level hysteria. So as a result, you know, I didn't like it, you didn't like it, whatever. But I am glad that so many people are seeing it, because there are a lot of people, hysteria aside, who are hearing this for the very first time. It's never occurred to them that when they disagree with their children or their grandparents, that it's because they have a different diet and they're busy eating, you know, informational junk food. And in that regard, I hope it gives some people some pause to consider what they're consuming.
I understand. The only thing I would say is that I think that that problem is so much bigger, and it really has so much more to do with kind of the underpinnings of what we've understood media to be, the chaos that has wrecked through it over the last 90 or the last since the 90s and really the 80s, if you want to trace it back that far, and the fact that, like, the media in general, the one feeding and creating these clips that then get sent through Facebook and social media, are just as much of a part of this as the other side. And to put this all on the algorithm is something that I think cheapens the idea and also gives us a false win. We can just rail against Facebook. We can just rail against Twitter. We can rail against the fact that there is, and it's even better because the algorithm is this magic faceless thing.
Yeah, alien, like, you know, influence.
This Kieran Culkin that's like, you know, just being awful to us. And that's not the case. We're torturing ourselves. We are doing to ourselves, and the media for which I grew up wanting to be a part of, and I guess I am now in a democratized form of it, is feeding they are creating the gasoline for it.
I think part of the thing that frustrates me is that, like, yes, but we can measure our polarity and how we're kind of pulled more into certain groups. We were way more polarized in 1950 when you didn't leave your suburb or you didn't leave your town. And you actually, if you looked at what people felt like in, you know, Fargo, you know, versus people who lived in, you know, Miami, you would find, oh, wow, no, these people are really different, very, very different, yeah. But they never interacted, you know, they never really interacted in any sort of meaningful way. And now we have the internet made, everybody's interacting, and then all of a sudden, the differences come to the surface, and the amplifiers make it worse. But, you know, there was no Twitter when lynch mobs, you know, were gathered around in the 1920s to pull some black kid out of a police station to go murder him. It didn't happen. Twitter didn't exist then, you know. People were even using telephones. People did that. Today, you have WhatsApp in other countries where if you look at the flow of misinformation and people rioting and doing lynch mob type stuff, that ain't nothing to do with an algorithm. That's a network. That's how information spreads across this network really fast. And my fear, and we've talked a lot about how much we don't like Facebook or the algorithm on here. I mean, we've been sort of, hey, be careful of this for years. But my fear is that, and then people go, and that's why we need somebody to tell us what to do.
Oh,
and that's the worst answer.
Yeah. And I do believe the R word regulation came up at some point. And of course,
details. That's the solution. The solution is we need to be regulated. And then secondary solution is that we should make Facebook something that doesn't make money, because that'll solve it. The problem is that Facebook makes money. And it's like, all right, I think that there is a good conversation here. I think there is a really good conversation because we are undeniably going through cultural changes. We are undeniably having a radical effect on our own world. But at the same time, the only thing that makes this as clear cut as the documentary makes it is Silicon Valley's reverse God complex, that it's all a bunch of people that were all a part of it that now need to wear a hair suit because, sorry, we were too smart and too good, and now we've ruined society.
Well, but also these documentaries are often made by the media on the outside that's frustrated they've been displaced. You know, it's made by people who were like, we liked it when we were the gatekeepers. Now look at these nerds in the Bay Area who are doing this. And how do we put us smart people back here to control things? And somebody asked in the chat was like, do I think social media makes misinformation spread fast? 100%, 1000%. But, you know, Ben Franklin, you know, what is it like, you know, by the time you've got your boots on, a lie has already made it halfway around the world. And like, yeah. And what's the answer? The answer isn't, well, therefore we need really smart people to tell us what to think. No, that's the wrong answer. The answer is like, let's create an environment where we're like, let's ask our betters to not be so reactionary. Let's ask the people who are wanting to tell us what to think. Like, maybe just don't be so reactionary first. Maybe admit when you're wrong. Maybe admit there's a lot of misinformation and not have to have a hot take 3 seconds after a video pops up on Twitter to tell us what this really means.
Boy, no kidding.
And that's the
I mean, if
and, that, and
if,
that's the.
I mean, I think much like there was a hot minute when Photoshop was novel and most people hadn't heard of it and they didn't know that 13-year-olds could manipulate images to create false things, and stuff spread, and then very quickly you got a savvy populace. And likewise, you know, this documentary indulges in one of my least favorite justifications of humans weren't evolved to process. We were only evolved.
Oh my God!
I hate that.
Just borderline eugenics. Honestly, like it's just like they are. Every time that argument gets made, it's to me, it's two sentences away from, you know, the pure skull shape that we have long. It's awful.
Anytime anyone says humans weren't evolved to, the thought that I thunk it like 5 years ago and it just bubbles up every time is, yes, what we are evolved to do is to rape and murder. That is literally what we were evolved to do. And it's only by suppressing our instincts of what we were evolved to do that we become civilized. And so I'm not a big fan of doing what we were evolved to do.
And I find myself, you know, I've been around people involved in science education and people with highly educated PhDs and degrees and stuff. And I will tell you, when the discussions turn to philosophical things, rights issues, politics and stuff, they are just as dumb as anybody else you know, but they don't know this and they think their opinions are so much more enlightened. And that's what drives me crazy is that, like, I kind of moved away from some organizational stuff because I watch people who are trying to promote critical thinking and stuff be the worst critical thinkers when it hit a nerve for them. And I'm like, if we can't be people who demonstrate how to be reasonable about things that are particularly hot topics for us, how can we communicate this to other people? And I think some of the worst people in the world are people who are the ones that want to be the gatekeepers, but they're the ones to have the quick hot takes and stuff and be completely wrong and not admit it and whatever because they feel themselves morally right.
Yeah. So anyway, my pick is The Social Dilemma, but more importantly, it's an anti-pick. And my real recommendation is, by all means, please, guys, check out The Pessimist's Archive. It's so, so good. I believe Bryce is pulling up the episode on bicycles it's so much fun. Just jump in. Once you read all the headlines and hear the actual words from the people who are boots in the trenches experiencing the hysteria, it's you develop this sort of armor, and it's like it just sounds similar to, you could recognize a short change not because you're familiar with it, but because you're familiar with the pacing and structure of a magic trick. You start to recognize hysterical reactions nowadays based on what you've seen in the past.
Yeah, we talked a little bit, like the reaction to one, like printed books, you know, was this was going to end the world. The idea of capturing stuff in text was going to end the world. Reading to yourself and not reading aloud. Like if you even in like England, they talk about like, oh, I went to, you know, I went to Oxford and I read such and such. Used to literally mean you would read aloud that. The idea of reading in your head, controversial, guys.
Wow.
Maybe you shouldn't do it. Just saying.
Chess was another one that had a hysteria. It was banned. I believe it's still banned in some countries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, that makes sense.
Man, I can't remember things I liked. I watched a lot. Oh, I don't know. Lovecraft Country. The more it turns into Harry Potter, the more I like it. So I'm still liking Lovecraft Country.
Man, Lovecraft Country is so it's so heterogeneous in its content that I almost always really dig it after I've watched an episode, but I never know, am I going to get a sweet vignette or watch someone's eyeballs get plucked out, you know?
I mean, boy, did they need to get to that body horror. They love that body horror. There's like one scene where in this episode, they literally, like, it's pretty artless. They like literally set up the thing in the scene before and then the scene after pay it off with this super gross out body horror. And it's like, man, they... You're not going to be more than 5 or 10 minutes away from something really gross happening on Lovecraft Country, which I'm fine with because I like gross stuff.
They spent a lot of money to figure out how to make skin flake off like that.
Oh, good God. And then find like 4 or 5 different ways that they can use it per episode. It is. I don't know. I like it.
I've got two picks this week. First off is a new Amazon original series. I know that, some people on the show liked the original. This is an okay pick for me. The Utopia remake.
Oh, is it a remake of the British series?
That's what I'm told.
Oh my goodness, I didn't know that.
Yeah. This was all right. My understanding, I have not seen the original British Utopia.
It's so good. I only watched the first season, but it's so stylish and scary.
And that's the stylish part is the thing that I have taken away as the understanding of the UK version. This really is not very bold or striking, which is kind of unfortunate because it sets up this very kind of wacky, I think kind of wacky concept. Oh, there's a comic book that predicted all of the virus outbreaks in the past, and now there's a new one, and we want to find the new one. And all of the conspiracy stuff around that feels very wacky and exaggerated and hyperbolic, but it's all presented kind of cheaply. Like, this is not like a substantial thing, but I find that it can't decide between if it wants to be striking and really interesting or like banal and like really normalized. So like there's a whole scene where an executive walks into a room and there's like words on the wall and it's like impact and disrupt, all these like buzzwords. And you realize, oh, okay, so this is like the office in the building where all of the social media people who like fake social media accounts work. And it's like, it doesn't look bold and it doesn't look boring. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like right in the middle in a very weird way. But at the end of the day, I did think it was pretty thrilling. I think it's worth a watch. And it was only 8 episodes. Like the big help is that it's only 8 episodes.
Man, I'd be so interested. The first 3 minutes of the British version of Utopia was so arresting. I get chills thinking about it. The music is brilliant, and the cinematography is great. I would be really interested for you to just take a peek at that first 3 minutes and let me know just how far off the Amazon version was.
Apparently that's impossible to do because it's still not anywhere to be watched. Utopia,
oh shoot,
the original. Yeah. But you could watch this and tell me what you think about that as well. My big pick this week though is the HBO Max original series Raised by Wolves. Man, this thing is really cool. This is really cool. We've talked about it briefly on the show, have we? No.
I think we did 2 weeks ago. The conceit is they send embryos far away and they have to be raised by androids pretending to be humans.
Yeah, that was my pick.
That's right. Andrew, yeah. It was Andrew's pick. I couldn't stop myself. This was just it's just fantastic. It is like a little bit of the puzzle boxy thing, but it's also like kind of core sci-fi and talks about, you know, really what does a future world look like? And there's a big war that's going on. There's clans and all sorts of mysteries around this planet. There's a lot of really good stuff in here. I think the only thing I didn't love was the end of the season, only because it didn't feel like the end of a season. But also, I think I complained about that in another show we watched recently on Cord Killer. So I'm not going to hold that too far against it. But it's great. It's highly recommended if anyone is looking for some good sci-fi, because this one's great.
Cool.
I loved it. I hear you about the ending, but I would say that, and I won't reveal any details, but just the idea that I felt like I got enough information about the world and the situation that I felt like, okay, cool. I'm kind of, it wasn't like Lost where like if people just talk to each other, you know, yeah, problem solved and whatever. And it's like, there's a lot of mysteries there and mysteries that may never be completely explained, but it's so much a show about survival and the different factions and stuff. I hear you. I enjoyed it because I think the character, like where the characters ended up, and it's not a point at where you're saying I clearly need to root for this person or I clearly need to root for this one. Yeah. But you're interested in everybody.
Yeah, and I think you reframed my issue with like it's not even a bad episode. The final episode, I think it's more just like this just feels like we would have another episode come up after this, and there's not one, and I would really like to watch
a chapter or
I mean. It's got reveals and stuff, but at least for me, it felt like, oh, we could keep going even. But I don't know. What did you think, Andrew?
I guess I don't want to get spoiled, but I would say that like if you step back and if I would say, well, look at look what was told us here and look what was told here. Like the universe changed that last episode. The stakes changed. Everything sort of changed in a big way.
Yeah, that's true.
And so that's where I'm like, and that's, it's like, I compare it to like the ending of like season one of The Boys was like, we got some answers, you know, and it was a great, I'm not going to give you the answer.
Sorry, I was mouthing the words. I muted everything. So I don't hear anything. So I won't be spoiled.
Are you watching season one of The Boys?
What's that?
We're talking about
Season one of The Boys.
Oh, good. You moved on. Okay.
I mean, he was using, we're not spoiling Raised by Wolves at all, no, but he was using The Boys as a metaphor.
Okay.
Ryan, I take spoilers religiously. My vow is I will not, I had somebody like, oh, tell, I'm like, no, I won't. I just won't. I was talking about season one of The Boys in the sense that like you got answers and the world changed and you felt so satisfied. I kind of equated I felt like, you know, there are bigger things involved, but man, I felt like, but I get your take on it. Totally.
Well, and that's one thing The Boys does really well is season two reflects that they don't come up with a conceit to go back to business as usual, but instead the whole game changes, which is a lot of fun.
I do wonder though, just as a meta conversation, whether the rules change any in our modern streaming landscape compared to what they would do in terms of, you know, like network television cliffhangers, that like the math on that's probably a little bit different in that A, season orders tend to come shorter, but more complete, right? It's not like streaming services are in the habit of buying half a season and then waiting to see how those numbers do before they buy the rest of it or even buy them piecemeal. But also like artistically, the vast majority of people that are going to see that story are probably going to see that. Like Bryce, you are in the rarity watching the end of Raised by Wolves, because the next person who really gets into it, probably by the time that season two comes out, everybody who gets into it from that point will literally the next episode is going to come right on. And yeah. I wonder if artistically any of that has kind of seeped into.
I think we saw a bit of that with Warrior Nun, because you did not like the cliffhanger that Warrior Nun season one ended on.
Yes, but I hated.
But the majority of people who experience it, like they'll see that and then they'll go straight into season two, which I think, and we've talked about this on Chord Killers, where like watching week over week, like really, I don't think I ever realized what a hit it gives. Like, I don't think I'm getting as much out of Lovecraft Country as I should because I'm watching it week after week. And I have to remember, like, it's been 2 months since I saw the very first episode. And I have to remember something I saw 2 months ago in order to get full context on what I'm seeing this week.
I think it works when there's a lot of conversation about it. For Game of Thrones, it worked because everybody was talking about it and dissecting it.
Mm-hmm. And the problem is that culture died. And that's the thing, is like streaming kind of came in. And now that we're in this like post streaming took over our landscape. Right. And now there's some places that are like, okay, well now we're going to go back to the drip feed for, you know, cause we want to maximize people discussing this, The Boys, Mandalorian.
This was a weekly release show, and when I was tweeting about it, everyone said, "Oh yeah, this was like appointment viewing for us at our house." And I think this more so than like a Westworld or something, which I think does have trouble being weekly. I could see like kind of the way that this is structured and having kind of ramp, because the season really just kind of ramps and ramps and ramps. So I don't know. I think that anticipation could play well into a show like
this. I think if it's everybody's watching the show, it works like I brought up Game of Thrones. Everybody was watching that, and so you could go week to week because everybody's having that conversation. But Raised by Wolves, when you're the only one watching it and there's nobody to talk to, it's harder. Like Witcher, if everybody watched Witcher and we're talking about week by week, great. But because it was this everybody, like Stranger Things season one, like that was like, I remember telling you guys, oh, you gotta go watch this thing. And that was this, and being able to watch it all at once is how that thing caught on. Mm-hmm. And like, remember the Raised by Wolves, they were doing the thing too. They were releasing two episodes at a time, which was smart.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay. That makes some sense. Yeah.
The other thing is that, here's the thing to think about, a crazy thought, and then I got a bolt, was Star Trek, original series, season one, first season, 29 episodes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Each, like
all of them self-contained. There was no week over week. It was nothing but procedural.
They had
right?
one two-parter.
But I mean, like as far as like big arcs, and it's like, oh, he used to have pointy ears. Now they're round because of this virus, or you know.
Season two and three got better, but like season one, like there was a lot of like, hey, there's no who, you know, there was a different doctor at one point, like who are Scotty and all this sort of stuff, you know.
Yeah. Scotty's on spring break for doctors.
every show was a bottle show, and you could see they were still figuring out the lore because in season one. He's with it's a Starship Enterprises from the United Earth Space Probe Agency.
Oh, wow.
You know, Kirk literally says that. And there's a comment about Spock about something. And Kirk's like, well, because you're a conquered species. Like,
whoa.
they lost a war. And and you realize by season two, they're like, let's figure there was no United Federation of Planets. It was Earth, you know. And then season two, they're like, let's make this a little more, you know.
That's amazing.
I gotta run.
All right, well, here, you want to take us out?
It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.